You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras American League Central. The Indians and especially the Twins are in the mix for a wild card berth, and the first place Royals have all but wrapped up the Central Division, but even they have hit a few bumps in the road lately. We kick things off this week with Royals reporter Jeffrey Flanagan. I think first and foremost, the biggest concern on everyone's mind is, guess who, Johnny Cueto. He's been a topic of discussion the last couple of weeks. He's lost four straight starts for the first time in his career. The ERA in that span, just under 9.5. He does not look himself at all. I think that there was only mild concern after one or two rough outings, but now that we've reached this point of four straight bad outings in a row, what is the thought process about Johnny Cueto here as we kick off the second week of September?
Well, you're right. I mean, there is a level of concern now, probably at the highest point of his career. What's interesting about his last four starts, and they've all been pretty much the same. They've not been good, but he's been getting beat on his secondary pitches, and he's been getting beat on pitches outside the zone. There's a crazy stat out there that opponents are hitting some over 400 against him on pitches outside the zone, and we saw that again Sunday. The White Sox Garcia, right away in the very first inning, reached out for a changeup outside that was about, I don't know, 12 inches off the plate, and you know, just kind of stroked a soft single in the left center. And that's kind of the way it's been going for Johnny. He'll make a pitch that he thinks is out of the zone and a chase pitch, and it ends up hurting him. Now, I will say one thing. His fastball has been really good, 93-94, two-seamer that's really been moving, and he probably needs to pay more attention to that and use that more often. And I think you'll see that probably in his next start. He's had a little bit of a issue with getting his rhythm going with catcher Sal Perez, and they've been working on that for the last couple starts. And he's adjusting to a new league, too, so all those factors weigh in. The team itself doesn't have a tremendous amount of concern. It's still fairly early in September, and he was brought on to help them in October. So they've got 3 weeks to 3.5 weeks to get it fixed.
And I know that not only you, but Johnny's teammates are getting to know the guy after spending his entire career in Cincinnati. He's in a totally new environment. But from what you do know of him, from your dealings with him so far, is he struggling with this right now? Or, I mean, in other words, is it really wearing on him mentally, or is he the kind of guy who just says, you know what, every athlete goes through this, even a guy who finished runner-up to the Cy Young last year?
I think you hit it on the head. Every athlete goes through this, whether you're a hitter or a pitcher or whatever. Hitters go into these slumps all the time. And, if Eric Hosmer turned around tomorrow and played seven straight games and went 0-for-4 every game, I don't think the city would be in a panic. Or they'd talk about him skipping or sitting down or anything like that, because hitters do that all the time. With pitchers, we generally don't allow them to go into slumps, and that's definitely what Johnny's in right now. I think he's handling it okay. We saw a little bit of frustration on the mound Sunday. We were kind of taking his right fist and pounding it into his thigh a couple times during the outing, and I think that came from maybe making a pitch that he thought was a good pitch, and maybe almost in the dirt, and next thing you know, someone lined it for a single. So there's a little bit more frustration on his face last outing, but between starts, he's been fine. He's actually been a positive influence in the clubhouse. He's really helped Yordano Ventura, who until last night had five just terrific starts in a row and probably was the hottest pitcher in the league. And so he's helped him with his changeup. And, of course, his good buddies, Edison Volquez, they were together in Cincinnati, and they locker next to each other. Edison's going through some issues, too. So they're all kind of struggling a little bit right now. But like I said, they got 3.5 weeks to figure it out.
And, Jeffrey, when you look at the last four outings and the teams he's faced, I found this really interesting. In order, they've been the Red Sox, the Orioles, the Tigers, and the White Sox. Now, all four teams, very solid offenses. None of them are going to even sniff October. So if you're a Royals fan, can you take some solace in the fact that he's getting beat up by these teams, but he's not going to see any of them in the playoffs?
Possibly. He's going to see good offensive teams. I mean, he's going to see good hitters no matter who you face. Toronto's staring at him, and with that lineup, that's a little bit intimidating too, but it's good practice for him. That Boston line, probably the best of the four there. Although the Tigers 1-5 are pretty intimidating too. And the White Sox, all these teams that you mentioned are pretty good 1-5. But the guys that have been beating him, strangely enough, are the guys lower in the order. That came true in a couple starts. So, you know, he's going to work through this. You know, he's a veteran. He's been through it many times before. And a lot of it's adjusting to the new league, I think. And, you know, I talked to Ned Yost about yesterday whether you might skip him a start. And they're not at that point right now. But, you know, maybe one more bad start. Maybe he does skip him just one time because they do have plenty of depth in the bullpen.
Yeah, his next start is going to be very interesting. If he goes out there and performs the way he can, then I think everybody takes a big sigh of relief. But if he struggles for a fifth straight start, it'd be very interesting to see what Ned Yost and the Royals do moving forward. Jeffrey, shifting gears here a little bit. Four straight losses now after Monday's 6-2 setback against the Twins. That ties the team's longest losing skid of the season. All four losses have come at home, where they've played so well all season, of course. Can we chalk this up to a team with a huge division lead, perhaps going through the motions a little bit, or is this something a bit more troubling?
No, I think it's just there's some transitions going on, too. I mean, there's new faces in the clubhouse. You got Johnny Gomes and Zobras and Cueto, a bunch of September call-ups. And Ned's been resting a lot of guys lately, and we talked yesterday to Ned about that, and he's going to kind of...
Rhett, a pleasure as always, and like I said, the Twins enter Tuesday just a game and a half back of the second wild card spot in the American League. Obviously, teams are ultimately going to be judged on their bottom line results, but given the way this club has already exceeded expectations, is this season going to go down as a success in 2015, no matter what the outcome?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the expectations coming in, I think a lot of people still have the Twins pegged as a last place team. A lot of young players this year have kind of come up and contributed. So in some ways, they're kind of ahead of schedule. I think this year, the Twins are hoping to kind of have a better year, obviously, than last year, and then kind of maybe build on this year and be competitive next year. But so far, they've been competitive throughout the season. So that's definitely a success. And like I said, the young guys, guys like Miguel Sano, have played really well. Eddie Rosario, Trevor May, Byron Buxton's got a taste of the majors. Hasn't played as well as those guys. But at least some of these younger guys we've been talking about for a long time are finally here and contributing. This is probably a little bit ahead of schedule and going into next year. Definitely some momentum with the way they played this season.
Rick, can you quantify the impact that Paul Molitor's made at the helm of this team and the success that they've had so far?
He's definitely made a huge impact as a manager here, kind of a new voice leading them, a lot of attention to details, a very smart guy and one the players definitely respect as a Hall of Fame player, but he can relate to the players. Has always been that talk of, you know, Hall of Fame manager, how hard it is to relate to guys who, you know, aren't as good as he was as a player, but he doesn't have that problem at all. He's very understanding, great listener. He worked in the minor leagues with the Twins as an instructor for a long time, so he kind of already knew a lot of these guys and could relate to them, and his, you know, in-game tactician skills have been very good as well. He's definitely a major reason for this turnaround.
And, you know, when you look at former players who inherit managerial jobs, you take a look at Ryan Sandberg, who kind of flamed out in Philadelphia. Then you look at a guy like Mike Matheny, who's had nothing but success running the Cardinals. You mentioned the minor league experience that Molitor had. How much of a difference has that made in him being able to better transition into this position, whereas other guys may not have that on their resume and they perhaps struggle?
Yeah, it definitely makes a big difference. I mean, this guy worked with a lot of the minor league guys, both on hitting and especially defensively and base running. So guys like Byron Buxton, he'd been around, you know, previously. Same with Rosario. He'd known these guys for years. Same with Sano. I think he saw Sano pretty much right when he got signed as a 16-year-old just to kind of get a feel for him. So these guys already know him. Like I said, he kind of knows the struggles that it takes, you know, especially early on in their career. Because, I mean, other than Sano, you know, you're going to have your bumps and bruises. And even Sano has kind of gone through a little bit of a strikeout binge here recently. So you kind of know how to roll with that and to relate to these guys. And even guys like Brian Dozier and Trevor Plouffe, he's known for a long time. And because of that, I think there's just a trust level because these players have known them, you know, known him since they were, you know, pretty much teenagers. And they can trust him. And like I said, just knowing how smart he is as a manager, how smart he was as a player, is something they can definitely appreciate. And they know that, you know, kind of things he picks up during a game, whether it's, you know, a tell from a pitcher, if he's tipping pitches, that kind of thing, or even just, you know, stealing bases and helping out with the base running. The little things he sees during the game and kind of tell his players definitely helps, too, just from being around baseball his whole life, you know, having a 20-year career. And then after that, you know, he was also on some major league coaching staff with the Twins and Mariners before. So he definitely knows a lot about baseball.
Yeah, no question. Understatement of the day. And to have him succeed, Ron Gardenhire, a near-perfect fit out there in the Twin Cities, Paul Molitor, the manager of the Twins. And speaking of Molitor, with regards to the outfield configuration, now that Aaron Hicks is back from injury, he's played a handful of games since a Triple-A rehab stint in Rochester. Paul Molitor has said he intends to kind of mix and match with the many outfielders at his disposal right now. But in your opinion, would he be better served to establish a starting trio given where this club is in the playoff hunt?
I think right now mixing and matching makes sense just because Buxton, I think, is the best defender of the kind of all the guys they have there, putting him out in center field as a rookie, but still not even hitting 200 yet. He's kind of still kind of figuring out the ropes there offensively. And Torrey Hunter had been in a slump there for a while, but has been getting out of it recently. A couple, you know, three-hit game and a double and a hit against the Royals on Monday night. He's kind of snapping out of that slump. So I think if they rotate pretty much those four guys in, the all-defense outfield is one they use in Houston, where, you know, you put Aaron Hicks in right field and you put Buxton in center field and you put Rosario in left field. And you've got, you know, a ton of range out there. And all three of those guys in the game they did that in on Saturday contributed offensively in the win as well. But like I said, with Hunter and his experience on the stretch, I think they're going to still kind of put him in right field here and there. And then in those games, they can kind of figure out if they want to play, you know, sit Buxton or maybe even sit Rosario against a tough lefty. So the nice thing is because they are, you know, Hicks is a switch hitter. You've got Hunter and Buxton are right-handed, and then you got Rosario as a left-hander. You can kind of mix and match based on matchups, which makes sense. So I think it's just going to kind of be a day-to-day thing, whatever Molitor thinks works the best. And so far, he's been making good decisions with that.
I believe in talking to Anthony on last week's podcast, you sort of indicated that the mood in the clubhouse was along the lines of, you know, let's just get back to 500 before we start thinking about the wild card standings. They're two games off of that 500 mark right now. So how much of a boost would it be for these guys to open up their MLB.com app and to look at the standings and to see, hey, we are a 500 club and now we can really get serious about pursuing this wild card spot?
Hey, great plug for the MLB.com app there. Now, you know, you're right. And I think that still continues to be that mentality. You know, these guys are, whether they're looking at the standings or not right now, they're saying the right thing, which is that they're not looking at the standings, that they're trying to take care of the business that's right in front of them at this particular moment each day. And that's really the mentality that, as cliche as it sounds, that Terry Francona has really tried to emphasize since he came in here as manager a few years ago. Just sort of that horse blinder approach to a season that, you know, early in the year when they were in such a big hole, I think some of the guys in that room were getting overwhelmed by looking too far ahead. And you seem to kind of feel that within the clubhouse, and it seemed to show within their play. And, you know, they made some trades, bring in some young blood, bring up some rookies, some kids that maybe don't know any better, as they like to say. And all of a sudden they're playing with a renewed energy. And, you know, obviously it's easy to say when the team's going well that they're taking that one day at a time mentality to heart, but, you know, that's what it's looked like. And this is a team that, you know, was very highly thought of coming into the season because of the talented starting rotation. And, you know, they still have a talented starting rotation. So if they can climb back into this thing and continue to hack away at that deficit and get within earshot of that second wild card, you know, they still feel they have the type of pitching and now the improved type of defense that could help them if they were to be able to get into a playoff-type scenario. But again, you know, as you mentioned, still two games under 500, still need to keep chipping away before we can really start talking about that being a realistic scenario. The wild card race right now is a pretty big cluster of teams, a lot of teams trying to leapfrog a lot of other teams. You know, so it's still a daunting road ahead here with a few weeks left.
And, Jordan, you mentioned some of the rookies that have been in the mix for this Indians team, the second half of the season especially. And one of the guys I just love watching throughout all the baseball, Francisco Lindor, we see what he's done on the field, the impact he's made offensively, defensively. And when it comes to rookies, I love to get the reporters' take on what these guys are like just in talking to them. What's their attitude? What's their demeanor? What kind of a kid are we talking about here in Francisco Lindor?
Well, I think what I've always been impressed with him, even when it was when he was very young, he went to his first Futures game and we had a chance to talk to him then. Just as young as he is, when you talk with him, you forget how young he is. You know, and then you go up and write and you have to type 21 in and you remember how young he is. But he's a kid that's always kind of carried himself in a much more mature manner. And I think the one thing he's really done since he's been here, and this is always the goal for a young player trying to cut his teeth at the big league stage, is to show right away that he's willing to do the little things for the betterment of the team. This is a guy that comes up and is very confident, not to the point where I'd say he's cocky, but he's very confident and has a very high opinion of what he believes he can be in this game. But he's done a good job of kind of tempering that since he's been here. And you know, if you want to look at one stat that would maybe indicate that type of approach, it would be the fact that he's already leading the American League in sacrifice bunts, which there have times where even Francona has said, you know, he should probably swing away, but he's taken it upon himself to move runners and set it up for the guys in the middle of the lineup. And that, to me, is just a statistical example of the type of attitude he's showing right now, which is, I'm willing to give myself up if it means that it could put the team in a better position to win. So he's taking a little heat lately for some of the bunting, but we saw the other day in Detroit, you know, when he decided to swing away, he comes through with a two-run triple. So, I mean, he's kind of doing all those things where he's making an impact. He's willing to put his stats aside to help the team. And then, obviously, defensively, you know, the guy has been an elite defender at shortstop, which has really helped shore up things up the middle for the Indians, which was a huge area of need coming into the season.
And Jason, as someone who is constantly around this Tigers team and has been there through the stretch of four consecutive AL Central Division crowns, kind of give us a sense of the mood right now and the mindset of this team, especially for some of the prouder veterans who have become so accustomed to having postseason baseball in October, but this season that's obviously not going to be the case.
Well, it's definitely different. I've been talking with different guys about kind of what I guess is the motivation going forward. You know, some guys talk about it as being motivated from a selfish standpoint, just trying to focus on your own game and make sure you finish strong. Other guys talk about trying to win as many games as possible. Other guys talk about development, especially with the younger players. I think it's a different situation for a lot of these guys, notably the veterans, and it's one where I think even with the different approaches, I think the universal sentiment is that they're trying to avoid that feeling of despair where everything really goes in the tank, even though really over the last 2 to 3 weeks, they've had more downs than ups here, and they've had some pretty rough series.
And Jason, I want to get your thoughts on Al Avila, who of course succeeded Dave Dombrowski as the new GM in the Motor City. Now, whereas Dombrowski has had to immerse himself in a completely new environment in Boston with the Red Sox, Avila's situation much different in that he knows this Tiger franchise frontwards and backwards. So what has this transition been like for him these past few weeks after he was appointed the new GM?
Well, I've been telling people that other than the change at the top, it's really the same organization so far. Most of the support staff has stayed the same. Avila moved quickly to make the shuffles they wanted to make as far as the current officials. And at this point, he's looking at more changes that he's hoping to make for next season. There's been a lot of talk about expanding a lot of support staff. There's been a lot written about expanding the sabermetric department, building out a department, really, because it was really only one guy previously. They're going to be adding the scouting department, I believe, with at least two new full-time scouts, so they're going to be boosting the scouting effort there. And they're looking to do some changes with the developmental staff and add some officials at some of the various minor league stops. So I guess right now the focus is a lot on the organizational structure and about, a rededication of resources there. But pretty soon it's going to have to turn to where this team goes for next season, both in terms of the manager and the coaching staff and also with the roster. And that's going to be a few weeks down the road.
And Jason, these pending changes that you're discussing with regards to scouting and development and sabermetrics and everything like that, were these also things being discussed when Dombrowski was there, or is this a completely new thing that Avila's brought to the table once he took over and Dombrowski was out of town?
It depends on who you talk to. I saw that Dombrowski responded to some stuff, over the weekend in a Boston Globe story saying that there was a resources allocation issue there with some stuff that they were looking to do some different things, but they didn't have the resources. It sounds like there's been some resources that have been freed up here since the move at the top. I don't know where it's coming out of or if it's just an expansion of what's being put in. But I wouldn't call it a rethinking. I guess in terms of the advanced metrics, there's a little bit of a rethinking going on. Although that said, and I've pointed this out to other people, the guy in charge of building out the advanced metrics was a Dave hire. That wasn't an Al hire. So even there, the build-out is coming from guys who were previously in the organization. I think what's just going on is that those guys are being freed up to do some different things now.
And Jason, of course, with the GM transition with Al Avila now in charge and the Tigers struggling this year, it's going to be the first time in 5 years they don't win the Central, that they don't go to the playoffs. Naturally, you know, it's kind of the nature of the beast. You look at the manager, you look at Brad Ausmus and say, well, you know, is he going to stay? Is he going to go? Personally, I don't see the Tigers doing something as drastic as parting ways with Brad Ausmus. But having said that, how much pressure do you feel is there for him to at least get this team to finish out the final 25, 30 games of the schedule strong and build a little momentum heading into the offseason?
Well, there's a ton of buzz surrounding Brad's situation and where the Tigers could go. I know that there's even buzz building about potential replacements right now and where the Tigers can move and how quickly they can move at the end of the season. Right now, Brad's trying to stay focused on the task at hand and about getting these guys to finish strong. Because whether he's back next year or whether he's somewhere else, this is all going on his record. And I think he puts a lot of responsibility on that. And I think he's trying to develop some of the younger guys to at least leave with a better situation than what they had at various points this year. So it's I think that's the sense where you get a lot of disconnect right now, is that the worse the Tigers have fallen here over the last month and a half since the trades of David Price and Cespedes, the bleaker the situation has looked. So it's there's going to be some tough decisions made. That's for certain. And I think that's where it's going to be really interesting to see how Al makes his stamp.
Scott, as always, thanks for your time. And like I said at the onset, the White Sox certainly turned some heads this past weekend as they became the only team all season to sweep the Royals at Kauffman Stadium. That is no small feat. But again, does it almost give the White Sox and their fans an empty feeling to know that, you know, this is how things should have been all season, not just for one weekend?
Well, you know, man, it's this story of the season has been the most, as I've used a few times in stories, it's been the most consistently inconsistent team I've seen in 14 years covering the White Sox and baseball in Chicago. You know, they swept Houston at home earlier in the year, who for all intents and purposes looks like it's going to be a playoff team, and then they went and lost 8 in a row. You know, they won 7 straight in Cleveland and Boston on a road trip, you know, game within one game of 500, looked like world beaters, and then fell out of it again. You know, they played two pretty poor games in Minnesota the first two nights, came back after Samardzija gave up a grand slam to Rosario and won game 3, and then just dominated the Royals. Again, the Royals were 32 games or 33 games over 500, not taking anything away from the Sox because they played great baseball. They did everything right in that series. And then came back and lost the first game of the series against the Indians with 3 hits, 2 of them from Avi Garcia. Got 3 straight walks from Trevor Bauer, and in the second inning could only manage 2 runs. So that's the Sox in a nutshell. That's just what they've done this year. And that's why, you know, as of this taping, they're 6 games under 500 with 26 games left and on the fringe of the fringe of the fringe of the playoff picture right now. And that it's just, you know, they should have been better. That's, you know, on paper, they should have been better. Sometimes on paper, it doesn't always work that way, though.
Yeah, that's very true. You look back at the winter, all the signings they made, the big splashes, and they were the sexy pick, if you will, to be that breakout team in 2015, to be this year's Royals, you know, so to speak, the team that really puts it all together and breaks out. As it turns out, the Royals were this year's Royals, but that's another discussion.
Right.
And, you know, Scott,
maybe the Cubs or Astros were this year's Royals, I think, so
true.
Far.
Yeah, very good point. Cubs and Astros certainly tossed their hats into that ring. Scott, at this time of the year, you know, every team has acknowledged whether they're one of two things, either a legit playoff contender or they're just laying the groundwork for 2016. You just gave the numbers on the White Sox, but inside the clubhouse, have they basically accepted their fate as they enter this Tuesday 7 games out of the second wild card? Or do some players and some personnel honestly feel that they're one hot streak away from getting right back into this thing?
Well, you know, one hot streak is going to have to be an extremely hot, like, do-not-touch type of streak because, you know, they kept saying it's early, and for a while it was. Well, now there's 26 games left. So to have a realistic shot of being in a playoff picture, you know, first of all, it's hard to talk playoffs when you're 6 games under 500. As I don't want to say mediocre, but as muddled and kind of average as that second wild card has been in the American League, while Texas and the Twins have kind of taken a step forward, you know, 6, 7, 8 games over 500 is going to win that spot at the least if a team doesn't get hot. So you're talking, you know, a 20-6 finish for the White Sox, which has just not happened this year. They haven't played that way at all this year. Now, with that said, they pretty much held to the fact where they take one game at a time and they're playing, you know, like they're in it until there's an X next to their name and saying they're eliminated. And that's how they view it. I think they know in their heart of hearts that, you know, after they made that run to get to five, to get within one game of 500 at the trade deadline, it was exactly they were 2 games under when they came home from the trade deadline and then didn't capitalize there. It was going to be an uphill battle, and it's a hugely uphill battle, like Matterhorn uphill battle right now. But until the X is there, you know, they're still thinking that they're looking toward next year, but they're still playing for this year. And, you know, it's interesting, one other point you talked about the offseason. You look at a lot of these teams that won the offseason, it looks like, you know, for the most part, none of them are, you know, you think of Boston, you think of the Sox, you think of the Padres, and they're all kind of looking, and, you know, from the outside in right now for the playoff picture.
Yeah, that's a very good point that, you may make headlines in the winter, but that does not always translate to success once the season gets rolling. So a lesson to be learned there for, like you said, you look at the White Sox and the Red Sox and the Padres, and definitely some examples of, getting too excited too quickly. Wait until you see some results during the season, if those results come at all. Scott, when you weigh preseason expectations against in-season results or lack thereof, can you call this the most disappointing White Sox season in recent memory for you?
Well, I think it's hard to say that. It's probably the most disappointing season in Robin Ventura's 4-year tenure. And I will say, you know, Rick Hahn, very level-headed, real smart guy, good baseball man. He said in the offseason, you know, we don't get an extra 10 wins because we did real well in the offseason. So they knew that a good offseason didn't necessarily mean they were going to be, you know, popping champagne corks and, you know, when the World Series is over. But I would say, you know, the first season, Robin, that they had a surprise year. They led for 117 days, and they just could not finish in September. They had a real bad last couple weeks in September, so the end was disappointing. 13 and 14 were basically rebuilding, reshaping the team, so they didn't expect to win there. I think they expected to win, but, you know, if they finish with 81, 82 wins this year, it's still a jump from the 73 wins they had last year. Now, with that said, huge disappointment because they should have contended. They know they should have. They had the offense. I mean, actually, they had the pitching. They had the offense in place, and they just didn't hit. And early, they had another bad start to the season, which is something they need to try and figure out how to fix. And their defense was bad early on.
That wraps up our look at the division. We'll do it again right back here next week. Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras American League Central.